Chapter 127. To you, Mr. Carker, who had sat and listened all this time, now raised his eyes, in which there was a bright unusual light, as I was about to say to you, resumed Mr. Dombey, I must beg you, now that matters have come to this, to inform Mrs. Dombey that it is not the rule of my life to allow myself to be thwarted by anybody, Carker, or to suffer anybody to be paraded as a stronger motive for obedience in those who owe obedience to me than I am myself. The mention that has been made of my daughter, and the use that is made of my daughter, in opposition to me, are unnatural. Whether my daughter is in actual concert with Mrs. Dombey, I do not know, and do not care. But after what Mrs. Dombey has said today, and my daughter has heard today, I beg you to make known to Mrs. Dombey that if she continues to make this house the scene of contention it has become, I shall consider my daughter responsible in some degree on that lady's own avowal, and shall visit her with my severe displeasure. Mrs. Dombey has asked whether it is not enough that she had done this and that. You will please to answer no, it is not enough. Apostrophe, a moment. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Carker, interposing, permit me. Painful as my position is, at the best, and unusually painful in seeming, to entertain a different opinion from you, apostrophe, addressing Mr. Dombey, I must ask, had you not better reconsider the question of a separation? I know how incompatible it appears with your high public position, and I know how determined you are when you give Mrs. Dombey to understand the light in his eyes fell upon her as he separated his words each from each, with the distinctness of so many bells, that nothing but death can ever part you. Nothing else. But when you consider that Mrs. Dombey, by living in this house, and making it, as you have said, a scene of contention, not only has her part in that contention, but compromises Miss Dombey every day, for I know how determined you are, will you not relieve her from a continual irritation of spirit, and a continual sense of being unjust to another, almost intolerable? Does this not seem like I do not say it is sacrificing Mrs. Dombey to the preservation of your preeminent and unassailable position? Apostrophe, apostrophe, again the light in his eyes fell upon her, as she stood looking at her husband. Now with an extraordinary and awful smile upon her face. Carker, apostrophe, returned Mr. Dombey, with a supercilious frown, and in a tone that was intended to be final, you mistake your position in offering advice to me on such a point, and you mistake me, I am surprised to find, in the character of your advice. I have no more to say. Perhaps, apostrophe, said Carker, with an unusual and indefinable taunt in his air, you mistook my position when you honored me with the negotiations in which I have been engaged here, with a motion of his hand towards Mrs. Dombey. Not at all, sir, not at all, apostrophe, returned the other haughtily. You were employed, apostrophe, being an inferior person, for the humiliation of Mrs. Dombey. I forgot, oh, yes, it was expressly understood. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Carker. I beg your pardon. Apostrophe, apostrophe, as he bent his head to Mr. Dombey, with an air of deference that accorded ill with his words, though they were humbly spoken, he moved it round towards her, and kept his watching eyes that way. She had better have turned hideous and dropped dead, than have stood up with such a smile upon her face, in such a fallen spirit's majesty of scorn and beauty. She lifted her hand to the tiara of bright jewels radiant on her head, and, plucking it off with a force that dragged and strained her rich black hair with heedless cruelty, and brought it tumbling wildly on her shoulders, cast the gems upon the ground. From each arm, she unclasped a diamond bracelet, flung it down, and trod upon the glittering heap. Without a word, without a shadow on the fire of her bright eye, without abatement of her awful smile, she looked on Mr. Dombey to the last, in moving to the door, and left him. Florence had heard enough, before quitting the room, to know that Edith loved her yet, that she had suffered for her sake, and that she had kept her sacrifices quiet, lest they should trouble her peace. She did not want to speak to her of this, she could not, remembering to whom she was opposed, but she wished, in one silent and affectionate embrace, to assure her that she felt it all, and thanked her. Her father went out alone that evening, and Florence, issuing from her own chamber soon afterwards, went about the house in search of Edith, but unavailingly. She was in her own rooms, where Florence had long ceased to go, and did not dare to venture now, lest she should unconsciously engender new trouble. Still Florence, hoping to meet her before going to bed, changed from room to room, and wandered through the house so splendid and so dreary, without remaining anywhere. She was crossing a gallery of communication that opened at some little distance on the staircase, and was only lighted on great occasions, when she saw, through the opening, which was an arch, the figure of a man coming down some few stairs opposite. Instinctively apprehensive of her father, whom she supposed it was, she stopped, in the dark, gazing through the arch into the light. But it was Mr. Carker coming down alone, and looking over the railing into the hall. No bell was rung to announce his departure, and no servant was in attendance. He went down quietly, opened the door for himself, glided out, and shut it softly after him. Her invincible repugnance to this man, and perhaps the stealthy act of watching anyone, which, even under such innocent circumstances, is in a manner guilty and oppressive, made Florence shake from head to foot. Her blood seemed to run cold. As soon as she could, for at first she felt an insurmountable dread of moving, she went quickly to her own room, and locked her door. But even then, shut in with her dog beside her, felt a chill sensation of horror, as if there were danger brooding somewhere near her. It invaded her dreams, and disturbed the whole night. Rising in the morning, unrefreshed, and with a heavy recollection of the domestic unhappiness of the preceding day, she sought Edith again in all the rooms, and did so, from time to time, all the morning. But she remained in her own chamber, and Florence saw nothing of her. Learning, however, that the projected dinner at home was put off, Florence thought it likely that she would go out in the evening to fulfill the engagement she had spoken of, and resolved to try and meet her then upon the staircase. When the evening had set in, she heard, from the room in which she sat on purpose, a footstep on the stairs that she thought to be Edith's. Hurrying out, and up towards her room, Florence met her immediately, coming down alone. What was Florence's affright and wonder when, at sight of her, with her tearful face, and outstretched arms, Edith recoiled and shrieked. "Don't come near me! ' she cried. "Keep away! Let me go by! Mama! ' said Florence. "Don't call me by that name! Don't speak to me! Don't look at me! Florence!" ', shrinking back, as Florence moved a step towards her, "Don't touch me!" ', as Florence stood transfixed before the haggard face and staring eyes, she noted, as in a dream, that Edith spread her hands over them, and shuddering through all her form, and crouching down against the wall, crawled by her like some lower animal, sprang up, and fled away. Florence dropped upon the stairs in a swoon, and was found there by Mrs. Pipchin, she supposed. She knew nothing more, until she found herself lying on her own bed, with Mrs. Pipchin and some servants standing round her. "Where is Mama?" ' was her first question. "Gone out to dinner," ' said Mrs. Pipchin. "And Papa?" ' "Mr. Dombey is in his own room, Miss Dombey," said Mrs. Pipchin, "and the best thing you can do is to take off your things and go to bed this minute." This was the sagacious woman's remedy for all complaints, particularly lowness of spirits and inability to sleep, for which offenses many young victims in the days of the Brighton Castle had been committed to bed at 10 o'clock in the morning. Without promising obedience, but on the plea of desiring to be very quiet, Florence disengaged herself, as soon as she could, from the ministration of Mrs. Pipchin and her attendants. Left alone, she thought of what had happened on the staircase, at first in doubt of its reality, then with tears, then with an indescribable and terrible alarm, like that she had felt the night before. She determined not to go to bed until Edith returned, and if she could not speak to her, at least to be sure that she was safe at home. What indistinct and shadowy dread moved Florence to this resolution, she did not know, and did not dare to think. She only knew that until Edith came back, there was no repose for her aching head or throbbing heart. The evening deepened into night. Midnight came. No Edith. Florence could not read, or rest a moment. She paced her own room, opened the door, and paced the staircase gallery outside, looked out of window on the night, listened to the wind blowing, and the rain falling, sat down and watched the faces in the fire, got up and watched the moon flying like a storm-driven ship through the sea of clouds. All the house was gone to bed, except two servants who were waiting the return of their mistress, downstairs. 1 o'clock. The carriages that rumbled in the distance, turned away, or stopped short, or went past. The silence gradually deepened, and was more and more rarely broken, save by a rush of wind or sweep of rain. 2 o'clock. No Edith. Florence, more agitated, paced her room, and paced the gallery outside, and looked out at the night, blurred and wavy with the raindrops on the glass, and the tears in her own eyes. And looked up at the hurry in the sky, so different from the repose below, and yet so tranquil and solitary. 3 o'clock. There was a terror in every ash that dropped out of the fire. No Edith yet. More and more agitated, Florence paced her room, and paced the gallery, and looked out at the moon with a new fancy of her likeness to a pale fugitive hurrying away, and hiding her guilty face. 4 struck. 5. No Edith yet. But now there was some cautious stir in the house, and Florence found that Mrs. Pipchin had been awakened by one of those who sat up, had risen and had gone down to her father's door. Stealing lower down the stairs, and observing what passed, she saw her father come out in his morning gown, and start when he was told his wife had not come home. He dispatched a messenger to the stables to inquire whether the coachman was there, and while the man was gone, dressed himself very hurriedly. The man came back, in great haste, bringing the coachman with him, who said he had been at home and in bed, since 10 o'clock. He had driven his mistress to her old house in Brook Street, where she had been met by Mr. Carker. Florence stood upon the very spot where she had seen him coming down. Again she shivered with the nameless terror of that sight, and had hardly steadiness enough to hear and understand what followed. Who had told him, the man went on to say, that his mistress would not want the carriage to go home in, and had dismissed him. She saw her father turn white in the face, and heard him ask in a quick, trembling voice, for Mrs. Dombey's maid. The whole house was roused, for she was there, in a moment, very pale too, and speaking incoherently. She said she had dressed her mistress early full 2 hours, before she went out, and had been told, as she often was, that she would not be wanted at night. She had just come from her mistress's rooms, but what? What was it? Apostrophe Florence heard her father demand like a madman. But the inner dressing room was locked, and the key gone. Apostrophe, her father seized a candle that was flaming on the ground. Someone had put it down there, and forgotten it, and came running upstairs with such fury that Florence, in her fear, had hardly time to fly before him. She heard him striking in the door as she ran on, with her hands widely spread, and her hair streaming, and her face like a distracted person's, back to her own room. When the door yielded, and he rushed in, what did he see there? No one knew. But thrown down in a costly mass upon the ground, was every ornament she had had, since she had been his wife, every dress she had worn, and everything she had possessed. This was the room in which he had seen, in yonder mirror, the proud face discard him. This was the room in which he had wondered, idly, how these things would look when he should see them next. keeping them back into the drawers, and locking them up in a rage of haste, he saw some papers on the table, the deed of settlement he had executed on their marriage, and a letter. He read that she was gone. He read that he was dishonored. He read that she had fled, upon her shameful wedding day, with the man whom he had chosen for her humiliation. And he tore out of the room, and out of the house, with a frantic idea of finding her yet, at the place to which she had been taken, and beating all trace of beauty out of the triumphant face with his bare hand. Florence, not knowing what she did, put on a shawl and bonnet, in a dream of running through the streets until she found Edith, and then clasping her in her arms, to save and bring her back. But when she hurried out upon the staircase, and saw the frightened servants going up and down with lights, and whispering together, and falling away from her father as he passed down, she awoke to a sense of her own powerlessness, and hiding in one of the great rooms, that had been made gorgeous for this, felt as if her heart would burst with grief. Compassion for her father was the first distinct emotion that made head against the flood of sorrow which overwhelmed her. Her constant nature turned to him in his distress, as fervently and faithfully, as if, in his prosperity, he had been the embodiment of that idea which had gradually become so faint and dim. Although she did not know, otherwise than through the suggestions of a shapeless fear, the full extent of his calamity, he stood before her, wronged and deserted, and again her yearning love impelled her to his side. He was not long away, for Florence was yet weeping in the great room and nourishing these thoughts, when she heard him come back. He ordered the servants to set about their ordinary occupations, and went into his own apartment, where he trod so heavily that she could hear him walking up and down from end to end. Yielding at once to the impulse of her affection, timid at all other times, but bold in its truth to him in his adversity, and undaunted by past repulse, Florence, dressed as she was, hurried downstairs. As she set her light foot in the hall, he came out of his room. She hastened towards him unchecked, with her arms stretched out, and crying, "Oh dear, dear papa!" apostrophe, apostrophe, as if she would have clasped him round the neck. And so she would have done. But in his frenzy, he lifted up his cruel arm, and struck her, crosswise, with that heaviness, that she tottered on the marble floor, and as he dealt the blow, he told her what Edith was, and bade her follow her, since they had always been in league. She did not sink down at his feet. She did not shut out the sight. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.